From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you look at the past 30 years or so, you can track the decline of American manufacturing. In the 1980s, 20% of the country's economy was factories that made things. Today, it's barely 10%. So where are the jobs going? Mostly China, of course. The journalist James Fallows has been to those immense factory complexes in China. And to be sure, there are hundreds of thousands of jobs to be had, but Fallows says things are beginning to change. In an article he's written for The Atlantic, he says the tools that turn an idea into a product, things like communication systems and technologies like 3D printing, are starting to favor the United States. Today in the program, Fallows will join us to explain the social and technological changes he's seeing and why he believes they suggest better possibilities for American job growth than at any time in decades. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about American manufacturing, and you know the story, that manufacturing in this country is in decline, that factories that actually make things are rare or disappearing. Well, the journalist James Fallows has been to those immense factory complexes in China, and he's saying things are changing. In an article he's written for The Atlantic magazine, Fallows says forces are starting to turn. Businesses are once again considering the United States as a place to make their products. He says companies in this country and elsewhere are working out these strategies that combine quick response and local skills and a global marketplace to foster manufacturing in U.S. cities. Today in the program, James Fallows will join us to explain the social and technological changes that he's seeing and why he believes they suggest better possibilities for American job growth in any time in many decades. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. His article, Mr. China Comes to America, appears in the December issue. He's also the author of a number of books. His latest is called China Airborne. It was about China's attempt to jumpstart its aerospace industry. James Fallows is joining us today from a studio at The Atlantic's offices in Washington, D.C. And James Fallows, welcome back. Welcome. Thanks for being
with
us.
Thank you. Nice to talk with you again. Thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to jump right into there's a question that you use to frame your argument or frame your article. It was posed by Candy Crowley of CNN during that second presidential debate. And you write about paying particular attention to it because we should say you were in China at the time. Talk about what she said and what sort of drew your attention to it.
Yes, this was the second debate. It was about foreign policy, and she posed a question to both Governor Romney and President Obama saying, we see all these American products, iPads, iPhones, et cetera, they're all made in China. What would it take to bring these jobs back to the United States? And the reason that was particularly interesting to me at that moment is about 2 or 3 miles away from where I was staying in a hotel in Shenzhen in southern China. A lot of those very products were being made in the Foxconn complex, one of the world's biggest factories. So I thought this might be the time to make another attempt to get inside Foxconn, see if I could see what those lines look like now, and to have an approach to this question from the Chinese side of the story and see what are the factors pushing jobs towards and away from the United States.
And we should say that the news item, that was a good peg. It got you in for the first time. I guess, did that surprise you that you were able to actually get into Foxconn?
It did. And I'm sure that many of your listeners have heard about Foxconn over the years. Yeah. It's famous in China because it's the biggest private employer there. About 1.3 million people work in all its factories in China. And even for China, that's a lot of people. It's owned by it's a Taiwanese-based firm, and a Taiwanese businessman, Terry Goh, is the CEO and the person who founded it. And in the last couple of years, it's been very controversial because of all the horror stories coming out about working conditions there and whether your iPhone is dripping with blood, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And when I tried starting maybe 6 years ago to get in there, I'd always been turned down. But this time, I think a different PR regime had set in at the company. They thought that their stonewalling tactics were only making them look worse than they otherwise would. And so to my surprise, they said, sure, show up tomorrow and we'll let you look around.
Mm. So explain what you saw there, because you say it was, aside from the particulars of Foxconn, you say just the experience itself, because you'd written about this before in 2007. Mm-hmm. You wrote a piece talking about just the sheer scale of all of this, how overwhelming in many ways it could be. You say the experience this time was surprisingly different from what you had seen. Go ahead.
So I think there are surprises on two fronts. One related to Foxconn itself and the role it's had in our public imagination and imagery over the last couple of years. The other is about this larger issue of how China is changing in its manufacturing prowess and the trends that may bode better for the United States in the years ahead. When it came to Foxconn, I think the big surprise to me was confirming something I had suspected but not being able to verify for myself, which was that within the Chinese spectrum, you'd have to say that Foxconn was at the better side of the industrial relations and industrial practices side of things within China. And the reason I say that is that the worst factories in China and the worst abuses there are the ones that we don't usually hear about in the U.S. There are these small, fly-by-night regional things where there's no safety standards and et cetera. The larger factories, which are subjected to international scrutiny and all the rest, they actually are better. And that's what Foxconn seemed like to me. The other thing, which was the other change, which was related to these sort of longer-term shifts, is the simple detail that the workers at Foxconn differed from ones I'd seen over the years, number one in being more heavily male. Yeah. It was a mainly male as opposed to female workforce. And number two, looking like city kids as right. opposed to farmers who just come in. And we can talk about the significance of those things.
Yeah. I want to get to all of these particulars, and we'll break this down as we go. Broadly, though, you believe the trends that you're seeing show some fairly good possibilities for the future of American manufacturing. Did that strike you? Is this something that's been evolving, or did this sort of come to you when you were in China?
It's something that's been evolving as I've been in touch with both American-based and Chinese-based technology people over the last year or two. Something that I've just loved doing in my work now for 30 years is just talking with people in some of the highest growth industries around the world, just because it's exciting and it's fun. Yeah. And through most of that whole time, the tone you heard coming out of American firms is they had all these great ideas, but certainly the United States was not a place to manufacture any of them. So I've been hearing changes in that theme in the last year or two. And then I was sort of bearing down on this when I was in China and heard a lot of sort of more specific things. And I think the heart of the argument came to three simultaneous trends. One was that things are getting trickier, costlier, just generally more complicated within China. Yeah. A second is that a lot of large-scale factors are pushing in America's favor, including this natural gas phenomenon, which makes lots of manufacturing more important here. And the third is that the newest wave of production technology, especially 3D printing, which we can talk about, and some other related aspects, was meaning that there were certain attractions to being able to do things right near the customer base. Yeah. In San Francisco, in the upper Midwest, on the East Coast, rather than shipping things to China.
Let's talk about some of the social and economic changes that you're seeing going on in China. This is, as you said, it's getting trickier. Wages are going up. The public is no longer willing to kind of look the other way about environmental devastation. Workers are becoming more choosy, those kinds of things. It's an interesting problem. It appears, according to some of the people you were talking to, China actually has been putting too much into investment in infrastructure, is something you write about, and not enough into, I don't know, actual consuming, I guess. Hyper-Keynesianism is how you describe it. Would you explain that part?
Yes. There's an economist named Michael Pettis, who's based in Beijing, whose work I followed for a long time. We were friends in Beijing. And he makes the case that because America has been afflicted so long with underinvestment, under-infrastructure development, under savings and all the rest, we tend to think that those things are absolute goods. And any amount of infrastructure investment, any amount of saving would have to be a benefit for society. And his point is that China has been skewed in exactly the opposite direction and demonstrates that there is such a thing as too much investment and too much savings and too much concentration on infrastructure. And the way this has happened is that over the last, say, 10 or 15 years, whenever there has been a softening in the Chinese economy or a need to prop things up or a way to support some local governor or something, the way you do that is to have some new building project. And so China is just covered with new cities in the middle of nowhere and new train lines not necessarily going to any place and 100-plus airports being built and all these things which may eventually be used efficiently in the Chinese sphere, but for now are just ways of putting people to work. And any kind of white elephant construction project we've seen in the U.S. is there a hundredfold in China, and it's worked to keep people employed over this last while. Mm-hmm. But there are all sorts of ways in which this overinvestment, underconsumption bias of the Chinese economy is creating strains for the system, one of a hundred set of strains on the Chinese system. And so they are having to ramp down on their investment, on their infrastructure, at just the time when we need to ramp up on those things ourselves.
You know, it's this idea of finding some kind of rebalancing. And this kind of equilibrium comes up even when, and we'll get to this later on the program, but this idea of there being, seeing economies, small economies in San Francisco and other places in the United States, but I guess even in China, as these kind of ecosystems. That seems to be a theme that comes up.
Yes. And back in my formative days, long ago in my intellectual youth, I paid a lot of attention to the work of Jane Jacobs with her famous book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And her theme was that national economies really grew from an assemblage of vibrant local economies, city economies, where you're able to have these tiny ecosystems that were highly diverse and you had the supply chains for developing this or that small industry. And over time, they became large industries. And part of the story in China now, which we usually think of as being the largest scale national level super planning, is also regional and city economies that really are what are driving things. And one of the people I interview in this article, he doesn't refer to Jane Jacobs and her book, but he's making the same argument about in China the role of Shenzhen, which is just north of Hong Kong and the center of a lot of this outsourcing economy, as being the real motor for China. And he argues that San Francisco is going to play that role, and plus a number of us other cities in the upper Midwest and the East Coast, of a kind of manufacturing renaissance in the United States, too. Mm.
That's Liam Casey, I guess.
Yes. That is Liam Casey, the man I have anointed as Mr. China. We can explain that, too.
Okay, good. Well, I want to go back to these social changes, again, in China that you were seeing. As you say, the big difference you noticed were that from these workers, male, more than you had seen before, and all really young. So they're more particular. They're not as desperate, I guess. They're the children of this other generation of workers who are part-time farmers. Talk about these young people because they're different. They have different expectations.
Yes. And the way I find most convenient to think about this is that if you imagine the social and economic change that's happened in either the United States or Europe over, let's say, 150 years driven by industrialization, that say in the early 1800s you had in the United States, you had the first waves of farm people, often farm girls, coming to the cities, to the mill cities in New England. And that was this transition of the early 1800s America of all the kind of adjustments to urban life. And then in the late 1800s, you had sort of the time of great abusive hyper-industrialization. You had the stockyards of Upton Sinclair, and you had the steel mills of Pennsylvania, and you had all the riots and union struggle and all the rest. And then by the early 20th century, the early 1900s, you had these city people growing up with all their new tastes and all their new expectations. That change has essentially happened within China in the last 30 or 35 years. Mm. You had, starting about 30 years ago, the first inklings of country people coming to the city and taking factory jobs. And even just 5 or 6 years ago, when I went into factories in China, you could tell that the people working on these lines were farmers. They had their skin was weathered the way farm people's skin was, and they were not used to city dress or city ways. What you see now is people who are city kids. They are the children of farmers. They never worked on farms themselves. They have fancy hairdos. They're wearing blue jeans. They're having all their iPads and iPhones and everything else. And the simple task of managing them and satisfying them is a whole lot more of a handful for these Chinese managers than one that was the case even 5 years ago, when just saying, okay, you're earning your money, shut up, be happy, and that sufficed then.
Yeah. You set in on a focus group of this new generation of workers, and they're saying, look, we're willing to work, and we're willing to work hard, but they also want some kind of a life, some kind of a social life beyond the factory.
That was really interesting. The workforce in many of these factories has become more heavily male, as females have other opportunities and better opportunities than factory jobs inside China. And so one of these focus groups was asking this largely male factory workforce, what do you like and what do you don't like? And in general, they liked having long work weeks and a lot of overtime because they get extra pay for overtime. What they didn't like was not being able to meet girls, not having any sort of structured activity on the weekend. So they wanted to have singles nights on Saturdays, and they wanted to have factory sports leagues and all the rest. They wanted to have what they thought of as an appropriate life for modern Chinese people and not just this drone life.
Yeah. The other thing that was interesting about all of that is that it seems like there's this kind of cycle that develops. You write about this churn, workforce churn, or the turnover rate, and it's pretty big there, about 60%, you say. Not high, not outrageous for Chinese standards, but fairly high. You talk about that Chinese workers at Foxconn, for example, they really – this is how the cycle works, you say. They kind of work themselves to the brink of emotional and physical exhaustion, and then they quit. They move on, which develops this problem for managers. They've got to keep dealing with the turnover, I guess.
It was interesting to go to a training session at this one big Foxconn campus I got into in the Longhua district of Shenzhen, where they have to bring in about 2,000 new workers every week. And that's because if you have a factory of 230,000 people and you have turnover of 60% or so a year, there's that many new people who you have to keep bringing in. And it was the reason for the turnovers didn't seem to be that people hated the work so much or were just so alienated because there were always tons of applicants for the jobs. It was, as you say, this idea of people who were 18, 19, 20 years old who were going to have this concentrated time of making some money, and then often with a group of friends, they'd go someplace else. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me like some young Americans working in a fish cannery or something for a while, or going to some factory where they knew in 6 months they'd make a year's worth of money, then they'd do something else. And this is one more side of just the increasing complexity of Chinese working life. It's not just one big workhouse anymore.
Mm. Which brings us, I think, you were talking about the – I was surprised at how many kind of connections there are to what's going on in China and what was going on in the United States, just in terms of its industrial development. Kind of brings us to Terry Gao, you mentioned, the head of Foxconn.
Mm-hmm.
And you compare him to Henry Ford. And you say not the Ford of the assembly line who innovated it, or not the Ford of the weird anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, but the Henry Ford who is said to have wanted his workers to be able to afford the products that they were making. Now, you're more circumspect about whether, in fact, that was motivating him. But this is really interesting. I mean, talk about Terry Gao, because you say he's as influential as anyone really in China.
Yeah, so he is a Taiwanese-born and still Taiwanese citizen businessman, now age 62, who founded Foxconn. It's a publicly traded company now, but he is the main CEO and the main figure there. He works in this tiny little office that is hard to differentiate from just some shed or lean-to. Cement floors in his office, for example, fairly different from the CEO of General Motors or whatever. But he is... It's intriguingly the case that for Chinese people who are now in their 50s or 60s, they study a lot of American history that Americans now ignore.
Yeah.
The history of America's industrial development. And what this man had learned about Henry Ford is that there was a way in which his lasting impact on America was not simply the Ford Motor Company, but his decision in 1914 to double the wages of all of his assembly line workers, the famous $5 wage, and that $5 workday. And the idea that this would be part of building a broader middle class in America capable of buying cars and other things. And that is part of the stated vision of Foxconn now, to be able to do something like that in China to help create a middle class that can buy Foxconn products.
Mm. Is this what they mean by that rebalancing? You know,
I think that this would be one symptom on the industrial level. I think at the national level, the idea is that America and China, we often discuss the U.S.-Chinese economic relationship as if China has all the advantage. They're holding our debt. They're having a trade surplus. The Chinese discuss it as if we're having all the advantage. Mm-hmm. We're living off their savings. We're living off their products, even though we're richer. I think the idea is that each of the economies is unbalanced. We consume and borrow too much. They export and save too much. And that each of them, on sort of a macro level, needs to readjust, as we're in the middle of trying to do now.
Mm. So Henry Ford was doing the same kind of things that Gao was doing. He was responding to this turnover that he was
mm-hmm.
seeing. That's why.
Yep.
And so Gao does the same thing at Foxconn. He's raising wages. He's done it, like, I think, four times or something this
yes.
year.
Yes. Yes, and I think there are two factors behind this push, a number of factors behind this push for higher wages throughout southern China, where Foxconn is the largest a private factor. One is the Chinese currency itself has been rising over the last 3 or 4 years. You know, the U.S. and China continue arguing about this, but the currency keeps going up. That's one factor. Second is there's not as many people to work, that the Chinese labor force is changing very rapidly because the one-child policy means there are fewer young Chinese people anymore. So there's kind of a shortage of this rural endless supply of labor. Women are having other opportunities. And so overall, there's this pressure in Chinese factories to think we have to get out of the bottom, rock bottom subcontract business and find ways to do something else. So Foxconn has raised wages unilaterally. The government in China has mandated a number of increases, and unions in China have won a number of wage increases too. So overall, the story in the last 4 or 5 years has been the opposite of our labor story. Our labor rates have stagnated. Theirs have been going up significantly, and they're trying to adjust to that phenomenon.
It's this U curve in terms of who benefits, as you explained, right? I mean, they're the corporate brand and the product idea and the design, that's at the top of the curve. And then the retail part and the service part, they're the other part of that. But way down there at the bottom is the manufacturing part. This is where China is now. And they want to bring that up, I guess.
Yes, this is my friend Liam Casey with what he christened the smiley curve 6 or 8 years ago. And the idea is you have something like a smiley face. And the shortest way to explain this is that while almost all modern electronics are made in China, technically, China takes only a tiny little share of the value. I have right in front of me a Chinese-made MacBook Air from Apple. Let's say it cost $1,000. Only about $100 stays in China.
Right.
The rest goes to Apple, and it goes to retailers, and it goes to chip makers in Japan and Korea and all the rest. And China wants to change that get out of that trap. And the major drama. There's a major economic drama going on in China now and a related major political drama. The major economic drama is there a way for China to become anything other than a bigger version of a low-wage sweatshop? And that's what this book I wrote recently, China Airborne, is essentially about, whether there's a way out of that trap.
Yeah.
The related political drama is whether a country that's now increasingly maturing as an economy and as a society can mature as a political system, because the political system is entirely out of sync with everything else in China now. And that is a major, major challenge to China's continued ability to progress.
This gets us to the heart of your article, you know, that the next round of jobs in this cycle may be starting to be more attractive for producers to sort of keep in the United States, which we'll get to as we go along. James Fallows is with us, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. His article, Mr. China Comes to America, appears in the December issue. And we have a link to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. And you should also check out his book, China Airborne. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the journalist James Fallows about American manufacturing. In an article he's written for The Atlantic magazine, James Fallows says the tools that turn an idea into a product are starting to favor the United States again. This is all about innovation and technology, and startup companies are considering actually making things in the United States again. We invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call. Kurt is with us in Grantsville, Utah. Kurt, welcome.
Well, it's exciting to hear that the Chinese people might be on the verge of being lifted out of their impoverished state. That's exciting. The question I have, though, is if we're thinking about the demand for American products because of our innovation, what is to prevent China from stealing the intellectual property so that they can just do it themselves?
I guess that's the question, James Fallows, is this really about intellectual property and copyrights and those kinds of things? In some ways it is, and in some ways it isn't, I guess.
Yes, I think you're right that it is and it isn't. And a couple of quick answers. Number one, this is a major challenge for China itself and for countries dealing with China. The reason I say for China itself is that people within the Chinese leadership recognize they're never going to have their own high-value companies if the people thinking of creating their own pharmaceutical or internet or aviation or whatever company within China know they're going to be ripped off immediately too. And so I think they recognize that one of many things that needs to change for China to have a chance to evolve is to have these traits of a normal modern society: copyright protection, rule of law, predictability, and all the rest. So it's a problem, and they realize it's a problem. Second, firms that are now manufacturing in China, let's say, for example, GE, which is building a lot of aviation jet engines and wind turbines and all the rest, needs to, in cooperation with the Chinese, they recognize they have to sort of be alert to this every single minute. The third point, though, is that the trend I'm talking about would in a way avoid some of that problem, because it's talking about fast cycle manufacturing right within the United States. It's not that you need to circle out to China and have things done and bring them back here, but you would cut out that stage. And tools that allow for quicker response production here would make that an even smaller risk than before.
That's the essential problem, the old problem, as you refer to it in the story, which is about delays in getting an idea to market. You know, it's about inefficiencies. And I guess the essential problem is cost. That's the old problem, how much it costs to make something.
Yes.
That's the heart of it in some way?
Yes. Here's something which is obvious as soon as it's pointed out, but it had to be pointed out to me by a number of people I interviewed, which is that the essence of everything in manufacturing is how many steps it takes between the idea you have to do something and that thing existing in a form that you can produce it at a reasonable price and sell it and get it marketed and all the rest. And over the last 30 or 40 years, increasingly, the way to have that done as cheaply as possible and as relatively quickly as possible has been to do it in China. you would be somebody sitting in Cupertino in California, and you'd have an idea for an iPad, and the way you could bring it to market most quickly would be to then go to your suppliers in China and say, here's what we are thinking of for this form factor, here's the kind of performance we'd like it to have, and you work with them, and that is the way you could get it back to your customers in California and around the world most rapidly. A number of technologies now seem to be taking shape that would make it faster to do more of that work inside the United States, closer to the market. Not all the work. China is not going to go out of business, but a larger share of the manufacturing work seems increasingly attractive to do closer to the market, and that's the coming change, that the timeless challenge of converting an idea into a product will not be there'll be ways to avoid parts of those trips into China that have seemed inevitable in the last 30 or 40 years.
Mm. Well, this gets us to Mr. China. Let's talk about Liam Casey, the fascinating person. And I want to point out, as you do, because this is a point that you say, you try to make in almost every article, that the country's greatest strategic advantage is that it's open to talented people who come here from someplace else. And Liam Casey was one of them.
He was until we made him leave.
Right.
And Liam Casey is an Irishman who's now, I think, 46, 47 years old. He finished high school but never went to college. He came to the United States when he was just starting out and set up a little business in Southern California. He now calls his existing company PCH International for Pacific Coast Highway, which was near where he was operating in California. But he couldn't get a green card, and we made him leave. So he now is based in China. His company is technically headquartered in Ireland, but it's based in China. He has 4,000 plus employees there. He handles products whose worth is it totals $8 or $9 billion a year. In your household, I promise you have something that Liam Casey and his factory has touched. But he is the guy who has essentially connected big American companies like Apple and others with the Chinese suppliers and made this linkage. And he is the one who says, who saw the way this linkage was necessary over the last 10 or 15 years. And he is the one now saying, I can do more of my work in San Francisco and California in the United States now than I was able to do even 5 years ago.
He says geography is history.
Yes. And what he means by that is that he's trying to say that when it comes to envisioning a market for your product, anybody who thinks of the market for what he or she is making as less than the entire world is going to lose out. You just have to imagine things which are going to be attractive to consumers in Europe and China and the Middle East and South America and North America and every place else if you want to succeed, because that is where the most successful companies are going to be looking. So geography is history in that way. And geography is history, he says, in another sense, in that he claims himself to be entirely indifferent to where anything is thought up, produced, designed, manufactured, sold, just because it's where the most attractive linkage of designers and supply chain and engineers happens to be. Mm. Over the last 15 or 20 years, that's largely been designers in California, manufacturers in China, and customers every place else. But now he says more of the linkage is going to be happening within North America.
Yeah. I want to get to the particulars as to why. Broadly, you write, blogging software, other similar technologies are making it easier for these people who have an idea to expose their products to a worldwide market and to test them. And again, this quick turnaround, the social part of it was surprising to me, that it wasn't just pragmatic testing of products. It was getting the word out.
Yes. And so I'll explain what I meant by this perhaps bizarre-sounding allusion to blogging software. One of the earliest lessons that Liam Casey told me when I was seeing him in his factories 6-plus years ago, he said that people think China is about cost, but really it's about speed. Yeah. And the main thing that matters in the modern economy is being fast. Fast to have your design be roughed out in some kind of physical incarnation. Fast to see which of those physical possibilities is going to work and which is not. Fast to see how you can manufacture these things, and then fast to get them to market. because trends change so quickly now and everything changes, that if you are faster, you will succeed, and if you're slower, you will fail, even more than cost matters. And he said that this was and the reason this affects the kind of the role of the internet and blogging software, et cetera, is that blogging software has had a similar effect on the world of ideas. Mm. 10 or 15 years ago, if I wanted to get an idea in front of readers, I had to go through a middleman. I had to go through a newspaper op-ed editor. I had to go to a publishing house. I had to go to some other established middle person because there was no other way to get my ideas in front of readers or listeners and to see which ones they liked or not. And the world of blogging and social media and Twitter has changed all that. People can get their ideas out for better and worse. And we know there are good things and bad things about sort of the disintermediation of the ideas industry. In the physical industry, he argues something similar is happening. The tools that allow you as an inventor in Utah, in California, in Georgia, and any place else to say, I have an idea. I think this would be attractive. Let's see if this could work. And you can produce a prototype 2 weeks from now.
Yeah.
And you can produce a physical object 1 month from now, they allow more people to take advantage of speed, rapid market tests, social exposure of their ideas than was the case before when only a huge integrated company like Apple was able to do that. So his main point was social media and blogging-type tools for production mean it's easier for more people very quickly to expose their ideas to a market test.
Mm. How was it that you put it in the article? You can fail more quickly. You learn what doesn't work more quickly, I guess.
Yes, and I've another person I've had the good fortune to spend a long time with over the years is Eric Schmidt, who's the CEO of Google. I met him long, long ago when he was nothing like the world titan he is today, and he was preaching the idea that the crucial advantage in the modern economy is failing fast, of seeing quickly what's going to work and not, and throwing out 100 ideas and seeing which 99 of them are not going to work, as opposed to taking years and years to discover that. So in manufacturing now, there are tools that allow people to fail more quickly and therefore succeed more quickly. So the rapid iteration, quick improvement cycle is easier to do and easier to do right on scene in the United States. This all sounds kind of airy-fairy, but it's what people who are involved in the work of producing tangible goods tell me is going to matter.
Talk about your experience at Lime Lab in San Francisco. You met a design engineer there who talked to you about the amazing technologies that are changing the process. Of course, among them, 3D printers.
Yes. And so there are a couple of companies within the Silicon Valley hardware pantheon that are very highly regarded. Of course, Apple is one of them for the reputation it has. Another is the design firm called IDEO, I-D-E-O, which has been responsible for a lot of very influential industrial design. And the man I quoted, whose name I believe is Adam Mack, was a veteran of IDEO, now working in this small design firm called Lime Lab, which Liam Casey's company had recently bought as part of its expansion back into the United States. And he was saying that he was very cagey about describing to me exactly the product he was working on because it was very sensitive and for a very familiar brand name company in the United States, which I now know, but I didn't learn from him. Right. And he was saying that what they were spending their time doing was to consider various approaches to a very major initiative this company is rolling out that everyone listening to this broadcast will be familiar with 6 months from now. And what they could do is they could dream up some way for part of this to look, and the next morning they could have the finished part in front of them through this process called 3D printing, which sounds like we're dealing with paper, but it's not. It's essentially being able to have very quickly rendered computer 3D objects. And that would have required, in the olden days, overnight shipment to China, having 4 or 5 days of industrial modeling there, having machine tools to get it done, and you can now do in 12 hours what would have taken 12 days. And just the fact that this allows the cycle time to speed up so rapidly, that is what was revolutionary in allowing them to compress within a few weeks what would have been years and years of R&D in the previous era.
Well, you mentioned the word revolutionary. One of the managers at Lime Lab, Linus Chung, I think it was, compared this to the way the internet had an effect on ideas, where it's really transforming things.
Yes, and I recognize that many of your listeners may be thinking at just this point, well, give me 16 examples of products that I already have now that are going to be affected this way, which I can't do because it's a process that's just beginning. And it's as if we were discussing 10 years ago or 15 years ago, there is this thing called the World Wide Web. And there are going to be these sites called blogs and even social networks that will change the way we exchange information. And listeners might have said, well, give me an example. And I would have said, well, I don't know, but it's all going to be different. And that's the way in which these people were describing that the general process of being able to convert ideas into tangible reality, if that has a radical increase in speed, then many, many things are going to flow from that in just the ability to have much more rapid development of promising ideas and not wasting time on unpromising ideas, and including allowing the sort of sprouting up of small firms that characterize economies in their times of greatest growth and characterize the United States 100 years ago in the time of Henry Ford and characterize Silicon Valley 40 years ago in the time when lots of small firms were getting going.
We're going to talk about some of those small firms. You write about some of them in your article. James Fallows is with us. He is a national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. His article, Mr. China Comes to America, appears in the December issue. We have a link to it on our website. His latest book is called China Airborne. We need to take another break. Kurt, thanks, by the way, for the phone call. 801-585-WEST is our number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist James Fallows. We're talking about how technology is transforming the prospects for American manufacturing. 801-585-WEST, the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. There's an email from Catherine who wants to know. You had mentioned, James Fallows, that Chinese female factory workers have better opportunities elsewhere. She just wants to know what you mean by that. Where are they? What are they?
This is a really major point, so let me just answer with a couple sentence worth. I was really struck on this latest visit to the factories of how what had usually been mainly dominantly female assembly lines were dominantly male. And I asked the managers why. Number one, the managers weren't happy about this because they consider female workers much better just in all ways. The men fight and they have riots and all that. So it becomes harder for them to control. But they said it was mainly because factory work was just less attractive to Chinese women than it had been, say, 10 years ago. They have more opportunities in education, more in the white collar world. Some of them may just decide to be independent or whatever. But the pattern that you saw 10 years ago of somebody who'd come in from a woman who'd come in from a country town and she was making money for her family, that woman might now be in a store, an office, a government agency, someplace other than a factory. And it was a very interesting development to me.
It seems like the real kind of peg here is, as you said, quick turnaround, but also quick customization, that a customer can personalize things like accessories and furnishings and clothing. And this is where you write about San Francisco and some of these small-scale manufacturing firms that are cropping up there. Talk a little bit about this, because these small factories can produce these products and turn them around pretty quickly, and that seems to be working. That seems to be the future.
Yes. And so we can think of big company and small company parallels here. For a big company, if it's some major electronics maker, the idea is they can more quickly shift their major product line and then do more of that design work here. For small companies, their edge is being able to have something that is distinctive enough and personalizable enough that it'd be worth the premium in cost. Yeah. The consortium of that's called SF Made is now several hundred small manufacturing companies, all based within the city limits of San Francisco, that have found ways, different variants on this theme. I talk about one called Dodo Case that some of your listeners may be familiar with. They make a very high-end cover for electronic products. It started with the iPad. It looks like a classically bound book. It's a sort of leather-bound, fine-binding case for an iPad or other electronic device. device, and they sell these for relatively high costs. I've bought a couple of them. They're in the nearly $100 a piece, and they're able to command that by high levels of quality and fit and finish, and also very quick personalization. You order online exactly the color and kind and fabric and configuration you want, and they're able to produce that very quickly and much more quickly than they could do if they were sending it out to China. And there are enough of these firms in San Francisco and other cities that even though one by one they are small, their collective employment base in San Francisco has been growing at a 10% rate in the last few years when overall business has been struggling in the United States. And so there are 15 or 16 cities around the U.S. that have these kind of local manufacturing consortia.
Mm. What's interesting, I think, is that you write about how you mentioned Craig Dalton, Patrick Buckley. They're two of the people who are owners of Dodo Case, managers of that company. And you write about how it normally takes something like 9 months to get a product from concept to delivery. But Buckley and Dalton, they had this Dodo Case idea. They didn't want to wait that long. They figured they really, in many ways, if they were going to be successful, they couldn't wait that long. They had to turn it around fast. Outsourcing to China wasn't really an option for them. So that's what made it work. They had to – being nimble, I guess, is the point.
Yes, and they had heard news that the iPad was going to be coming out, and they thought if they were to have a chance with this tiny firm they had and this idea, they didn't even have a prototype yet. If they had the idea for this fine binding approach to electronic covers, they'd have to be out there right away. And so they called on some of the woodworking expertise that was in San Francisco and some of the old classic printing press equipment that had been used during San Francisco's time as a fine printing center and some of the sewing talent that was there. And so within a couple of weeks, they had prototypes, and they were able to come to market very, very quickly. And so this was an example of the importance of speed. They didn't use any fancy pants 3D printing here, but it was showing the way that certain kinds of products are now, again, featuring a local manufacturing base because nimbleness, customization, and response time are more important again.
So the question is, you know, a lot of this, of course, this is these particular companies you focus are in San Francisco. You know, this amazing level of creativity and energy there. I guess the question is, can you find these same kinds of ecosystems, these small-scale manufacturers, you know, taking advantage of the gifts of Salt Lake City, of Boise, Idaho, of Des Moines, Iowa? You know, can that same idea be transplanted, or is San Francisco somehow unique?
I'd answer in several ways. Certainly every place is unique with its own, you know, its own history and all the rest. And so San Francisco has certain advantages. But point two, The San Francisco Manufacturing Consortium is part of a growing body of similar efforts, and I heard about similar things in Philadelphia and in several cities in Michigan and in Atlanta and in parts of Texas. I don't know of ones in Utah, but there might be some there. Point three, I'm going to make an effort myself to see more of these in the months ahead. And point four, I think the idea is this is historically how economies have grown everywhere. And so we've been so intent on the fate of big industries, we forget they all start small. And so a concentration on the conditions that foster small creativity may be the next step for the United States in toto.
You know, it did make me wonder. Dodo Case has been really successful, and it's growing, of course. But what happens, and you raise this question in the piece, what happens when a boutique idea becomes a global brand? You know, can they stay in San Francisco? Can they stay in the United States? When the scale changes, won't they have to go to China?
I think that they certainly will do more of their work overseas if they become more successful. They already have about a third of their sales internationally, and they are very ambitious to become a global brand. They have The Gap and Levi's as an example for the kind of presence that they'd like to have. So I think the idea is not that they would ever become entirely domestic in their production base, but that as time goes on, if they can have important parts of their work done here, then the United States is much better off than if they didn't grow. So I think the idea is that in a growing pie, there will be more American work than there would have been the case if they didn't grow. And I think that's the standard.
One revelation is interesting. You write about the fact that the United States still really does have pretty good infrastructure in place for this coming change. You talk about a still strong university system and public research system, good financial and sort of cultural underpinnings for startup cultures, and of course immigration, which is you mentioned all the time. So we have the basics in place to sort of take advantage of this opportunity, you think?
And also it's the case that the biggest manufacturing sector in the world is still America's,
right.
Believe it or not, still even larger than China's. Yes, the short version I'd make here is that America has terrible problems, as we all know. But America's problems are all ones of relatively minor adjustments. If you compare them with the huge contradictions that China faces, for example, or the very deep depression that much of a European economy seems to have sunk into, all we need to do is make sort of adjustments at the margin and not throw away the advantages we still have in our finance structure, in our university structure, in our research tradition, in our startup tradition. So we have problems, but they are ones the rest of the world envies.
Mm. Country needs to have what you call large-scale policy. So national investment in high technology, training for a new generation, all of those things, I guess.
And maybe it's better – maybe it's easier to undertake those things if we understand that our situation is more promising than we usually think. If we think it's just a one-way trip down the economic toilet, which is the way that's usually discussed in political terms, then you think, well, what's the point of even trying? But again, there are serious problems in the United States. Economic inequality has reached Gilded Age proportions. They're just – that needs to be addressed and – public finance obviously has its problems, but these are problems of adjustment and rebuilding opportunity as opposed to needing to make revolutionary shifts in our national course. So I think that can be a way to look with more confidence towards the next few years.
Mm. You feel fairly optimistic in some ways, James Wallace?
I am an optimist by nature, yeah. As may have come through by now. I think that our political culture has reasons to be to give us cause. But again, if you let's talk about China for a moment. China faces some truly basic contradictions. Its political system cannot endure with its current current economic and social structure. One or the other has to give. That's not our case. Our political system needs to be made less sort of parasitic, less dysfunctional, but we've been through these cycles in our past. We need to find ways to have better opportunities for most Americans. But again, these are adjustment and rebound challenges as opposed to really looking into the abyss.
That's James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. His piece, Mr. China Comes to America, appears in the December issue. We should also mention his latest book, which is called China Airborne, was released earlier this year. He joined us from a studio at The Atlantic's offices in New York City. And James, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for giving me this time.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.